Welcome to Polycast, a civilization podcast focused on game strategy. Dan Q.
Makalua.
The Mian Team.
Ed Jin.
With guest co-hosts.
Byte.
Sleazy Sarge.
You're good with doing the introduction, right?
As long as I have everyone's name so I don't sound...
ZD Zarish does not want going, ugh. Way to treat the first time guest trying to. Wow, that was.
Well, g'day, everyone. Welcome to Polycast number 290. My name's Byte, and I am a guest host today. Joining me today is Dan Q.
Guess who's back?
Makalua.
Backstreet's back.
All right.
The Me in Team.
Oh my gosh, I have electricity.
Woohoo! Phil did not die to a hurricane!
Phil has successfully researched electricity.
And ZT Sarish.
Early game progression, boys.
Scientists in Civilization 6. Rating them, and I realize rating them is not the same as ranking them, but I kind of have to do that because that's just me. That's how I roll. Now, unlike some other great people that have been talked about on the last two episodes of the show, there's actually a reason to talk about rating them and indeed ranking them individually because they have their own individual effects. In terms of rankings, I think about a couple of things when it comes to great scientists. One, and this is not necessarily an order of importance, but the first thing I look at is an era. I know there are advanced arts people out there, so you're not going to see some of these people, or you would rank something maybe a little higher than I would, but to me, the earlier the better. Number two, it is something specific. We tie a specific value to some particular thing. So when it comes to all of those, hey, you get a bunch of Eureka bonuses for X number of technologies in a particular era, yeah, I generally rank those lower, not because they're bad, but simply because I don't have as much control over that. If we were able to choose perhaps the Eurekas, or it was somehow tied to what we were already researching, that would be very, very, very nice. With that said, I am going to rank in first place Hypatia. You instantly build a library in this district. Libraries provide plus one science. So for me, I look at this great scientist. It's coming around typically when I'm working on my second campus. Second campus is being constructed, or it's about to be constructed. I'm watching that great person screen, and oh, I'm going to get this individual. So I send my great scientist to the campus that already doesn't have a library in it, even if that means a few turn delay, that's fine, because it's probably going to take me more than a few turns to construct a library otherwise, and even if I have enough gold to buy a library, I'm probably thinking about some kind of military units to go squash barbarians or some other such. But the library is providing plus one science that early on, which is then replicated with any other library that you construct in any other campus district across cities that you build and or capture. Awesome.
Yeah,
I agree with you.
Completely agree with you.
I don't, but it's fine.
I'm hoping number two is Isaac Newton, because that's the university version.
Oh, yes.
Yes, yes. Isaac Newton is the second version. You instantly build a university and a library in this district, and universities provide plus two science available in Renaissance. There's also a closely related one for additional science output coming in the modern era, which is Mr. Einstein, where universities provide plus four science. Although, quite frankly, because it's later on, the plus four science is nice, don't get me wrong, but if I missed out on Hypatia, I will be really disappointed if I missed out on Isaac Newton as well. They're powerful enough for when they appear in the game, and there's enough of an additional output, particularly you're thinking, well, Dan, modern era, that's kind of late in the game. Yeah, but that's universities you already have, and that's plus four science. So if you have half a dozen cities... Wow, there's 24 additional science. That could be a 10, 15, 20% boost to your science instantly, the output that you were doing otherwise, just as a result of getting and then activating this great person. It is true, you don't necessarily go ahead and construct a campus in every single city, but when Hypatia appears in the game, all of my cities are going to be having a campus. And typically, if they're not the first build, then they're the second after a commercial hub. Knowing that I get that instant boost with the library, plus then that's going to continue carrying on for the rest of the game over how many turns are left. So you think about how much science over the course of the game, however many turns you multiply that out, that's a considerable amount.
What's your typical estimate for how much science you generate as a result of making one of these great people? Have you run the math on that? I'm just curious.
No, but I'm just looking at what else am I going to have to do in the game in order to get that additional science elsewise from having that great scientist.
I admit he's probably the strongest of the classical era great scientists, mostly because the others are really weak. Something like Galileo getting 3 adjacency bonuses is going to trash it. Easy. So let's pretend you're getting, like, I don't know, 5 to 10 science per turn for, like...
100 turns.
Yeah. You're getting maybe 500 science if you're doing that. And that is somewhat front-loaded, so that's helpful. But compared to, like, getting all Eurekas for Modern Era or... just a flat amount of science from something like Charles Darwin or Galileo, mm-hmm. which you can get a lot of science very quickly off that, it's going to be pretty difficult, actually, because you still have to make those libraries and those campuses, which means they're not instantly available in every city. So you're making a pretty positive estimate to get 500 science off of these guys in a meaningful time frame of the game. It's still good, but I just could not put that near the top. Something like Space Race Project production is pretty huge. I mean, if you are attempting that, it's pretty hard to match that utility because you're really bottlenecks there on the hammer side or cog side of things.
I guess I kind of look at someone like Galileo, so people listening, I'm sorry, what does this person do again? You're getting 250 science on standard speed for every adjacent mountain tile, and let's, of course, I think someone also mentioned Darwin, where you're getting 500 science, again on standard speed for every natural wonder tile here or adjacent. At the particular point that I would perhaps see Galileo or Darwin, I look at how much science output I am doing, and I think, okay, well, at this point in the game, that comes down to the equivalent of 3 turns worth of science. And it very much depends on not only when they appear in the era, but, and I think Galileo is definitely better than Darwin, because you're almost certainly going to have some decent mountain tiles that you're going to be able to go to.
Yeah.
As opposed to perhaps a natural wonder. Galileo came a little earlier, or I was able to push through, like just barely get into Renaissance, and then that becomes the next great scientist that becomes available, then wow, maybe that's the equivalent of 10 turns worth of science at that point, as opposed to a handful.
You're still talking, you're getting science or you're getting science?
Oh yeah, absolutely.
If you're able to get 500 or 750 science standard speed. You back adjust all of that for online. If you're able to get that much, it's pretty challenging to overtake that with most of the other options.
It's the earlier eras for them, plus the ability to plan for them. Because it's like, oh, well, I do have mountains, and oh, look where Galileo has actually spawned, for example. Okay, so how many turns is it going to take me to get over there? Oh, okay, now I can go ahead and I can certainly do that, and then I'll take that benefit from it, but I think... okay, kind of the mid-later point of the game, I've shaved a half a dozen turns, maybe, off of whatever it is that I'm currently researching, whereas I can snowball effect and have Hypatia, Albert Einstein, Isaac Newton, some combination of those three, and I know that they're going to be giving me something instantly when I activate them, and I'm going to be activating them more quickly, probably, because they're not going to have to travel as far, probably. But you're absolutely right. It is difficult, even when you're comparing the great scientists. There are still a lot of situational things that come around.
Okay. And I think you're overrating per-turn stuff. I mean, this was a common mistake in Civ 4 as well. I mean, they're not bad, but you're overrating the per-turn stuff.
Yeah, and I think you're overvaluating the full science that you get because at the point that Galileo and Darwin would come around, 2 or 3 turns.
You can almost guarantee get at least 500 from Galileo. And not only can you almost guarantee get that, it's still relevant in the Renaissance era, and it's probably more than you're ever getting from Hypatia. So the only case you can make is that the several hundred science you're getting sooner from Hypatia is worth it because it's available sooner.
So many of these like games close out early. You're getting this, whether the game goes long or not, right?
Yeah, that's true.
That's the kind of nice point. It's like, oh, I want to close this out by like Renaissance.
Well, if you're doing that, though, I'm not sure that great scientists are in the cards for you. You're probably building generals
Like if you're going for like a build where you go up to that and then you switch full on to war after that, or
But if you're going like an all in like that, I would like the I would definitely like Eureka's if you're going all in on particular unit, unless you're going late.
See, I'm with Dan here. I don't like random Eurekas. I don't like just the surprise, oh, what am I going to get? Oh, it's not something I'm going to get, or it's something I was probably going to get the Eureka for anyway. So it always feels a bit, eh, whenever I get a bonus Eureka thing from a great scientist or a goody hut or something.
Well, it depends on the scientist, because there's a difference between, like, one random or two random technologies from this era and, like, all the technologies in this era, or you have one guaranteed, like, chemistry or something, and you know you can get it. So, yeah, I mean, there are definitely differences between the Eureka-based scientists as well.
Speaking of other great scientists, though, I would put Alfred Noble next. Yeah, he is in the modern era. Yeah, there's this trigger Eureka moment for one random technology for the modern and atomic era. But then you're going to get 23 great person points towards recruiting all current and future great people. Now, you might be saying, now, Dan, at this particular point in the game, is that 20 really going to give you that much of a competitive advantage? Well, at that point, there's probably very few left. Great people. Like, if this was just for 23, you know, great scientist points, I wouldn't rank it this high. This is all great people. That could give you that little bit of boost that you need, along with everything else that you're doing in terms of the great person output, to actually get some of those last few great people. Great engineers, for instance, or if you're going culture, like a great musician or great artist or something like that. And then, of course, there's the information era, I love you, space race project.
Yeah.
Carl Sagan and Stephanie Kowlick. Carl Sagan will give you 3,000 production towards space race project construction, and Stephanie will give you plus 100% towards space race projects. I could see arguments for interchanging between would you put Carl before Stephanie or Stephanie before Carl, and I'm going to put Carl ahead because that's 3,000 production. Across all of your cities, if you are doing the equivalent of 3,000 production...
Don't you need to build those ships?
If you've got multiple spaceports...
Yeah, that's the thing.
Then that 3,000 is just suddenly, oh, you complete this turn, and this next turn, and this next turn. Or even if you only have one spaceport, like in one game there are one space victory, I only had that, but I completed however many components there are for the spaceship, all but one I completed on the next turn, after having just constructed the spaceport only a dozen turns before. And there was no way... There was no way that I would be able to do that any faster, whereas if I've just got one spaceport and I've got plus 100% production towards space race projects, that's great for that city, and I've constructed a spaceport, there better be decent production in there, but that's not going to help me as Carl Sagan would, particularly in that situation.
Oh, wait, overflow is applied one-to-one in this game, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Is it capped?
No.
So if you got both of these, you can break the game, basically.
Oh, yeah.
You almost finish a part, then you slap down Carl Sagan while you're already getting the plus 100%. My God, that's broken.
And of course, if you're listening to this and you're thinking, but Dan, I never go space race. I wouldn't rank this high. Well, of course, that's understandable. I've only got a culture victory incidentally.
Oopsies.
That's because I was going for conquest, and I swore. The thing is, I already had a domination victory. I was trying to avoid culture, but anyway... All hate mail. Mary Leakey in the Atomic Era. Your artifacts in all of your cities generate 300% of the normal tourism. You gain 350 science for every artifact in this city. A 300% of the normal tourism? Wow, when you're trying to attract tourists to your land at the expense of others, assuming, of course, that you have a decent amount of artifacts, whatever that happens to be, depending upon your map size and your opponents, or etc. But at that particular point, that sounds pretty dang powerful if you were going for this thing called a cultural victory.
It does seem with the culture victory that whenever I've got it, it's always been a, oh, surprise. Oh, it
happened.
I was
going to win anyways.
Well, the song again tells you the rules about it, so that's part of the problem. There's some major missing information on the details of attaining this victory condition.
That's true.
And I hate that.
Elsewise, on the great scientist list, Abu al-Qasim al-Zahari.
Abu al-Qasim al-Zawari? You were very close.
Ish, very ish.
Abu has a passive effect and a retire effect. So the passive effect is bonus healing for the player's units within one tile.
Yeah.
Retire. Triggers the Eureka moment for one random technology from the medieval or Renaissance era. Wounded units can heal plus 5 hit points each turn. I point this out more about as its uniqueness, where it's got this passive ability and the retire ability. It sounds really nice, but in effect... How good is that really going to be? Plus 5 hit points each turn? Comes in the medieval era. It's not bad, but It's certainly not as good as the science ones that we've been talking about or the space race runs, and questionable even with regards to the culture ones.
It's like a scientist you would fish for in a domination game on a slow sit bead. Healing is kind of slow, and plus 5 isn't impressive enough for me to want to rate it really high. But when you're going to be using units for a long time, I could see it. But yeah, we're getting out of the good stuff now.
Oh, definitely.
Aside from the fact that you're underrating some of the Eureka ones that are actually good.
Janaki, Amal, gain 400 science for each rainforest tile here or adjacent. I mean, I'm thinking, are you Congo? Are you Brazil? Then
you can almost always find some, though.
Yes.
Yeah. Either by going to Congo or Brazil, yeah, or by just walking into some rainforest somewhere.
Oh, hey, look, I'm surrounded entirely by rainforest and standing in rainforest. Woo, science!
Yeah, and that's a lot of science. A lot of science.
I think I had this guy in one of our multiplayer games a couple of weeks ago, and I was like, oh my god, this is the best.
It is Atomic Era, and I guess that 400 science, that's on standard speed.
Yeah.
Just thinking about, especially in the Atomic Era, what my scientific output is, if that was stuck in, say, even Renaissance or Industrial, then you could probably find a pretty decent cluster of rainforest. But I'm thinking more often than not, in the Atomic Era, yeah, if there's Brazil or Congo on the map, go find them and put them there. Or maybe if you're on a map that's got, hey, look, I know that there's a lot of rainforest here, then, yeah, that could be one that you're going to want to go for. But I think he's even more situational than certainly the mountain one and possibly the natural wonder one, too. I mean, at some point in the game, you are going to discover all the natural wonders, or at least enough natural wonders to make worth getting that guy decent. You may not luck out with regards to the rainforest.
You should know where these things are by the time these guys are available, like if you're scouting at all, which if you're trying, you should be.
James Young Industrial Era. Reveal oil without the normal technology requirement. Triggers the unique moment for 2 random technologies from the industrial or modern era. If this was perhaps a certain other great person that might have been talked about on earlier episodes, that's going to give me an oil. That's a completely different ball of wax. Whereas this one, revealing oil without the normal technology requirement, usually that's just, oh, it revealed a little sooner that I don't have oil yet and I need to go squash someone for it.
Yeah. It's kind of that's nice, but it's better when I get it given to me through that great merchant.
Yeah, and since I'm going to be able to discover that anyway, you're going to reveal oil not too long after that down the technology path, it's nice, but it's not something that's, wow, this is amazing, and I wish I had it.
Yeah, he's probably more useful for the Eurekas, honestly.
Yes, I would agree with that.
You do get 2, at least.
In the medieval era, Hildegard of Bingen. This Holy Sites of District Faith adjacency bonus provides science as well. Gain 100 faith. If religion was in Civilization 6 like it was in Civilization 5, I'd be enjoying this a little more. But pursuing religion myself, I think you're farther behind because you're having to pursue religion at the expense of something else, gold, science, production. I just don't think it's worth it.
It's not bad if you're playing Australia and you get a really good adjacency bonus, but other than that, it's a bit meh.
Okay, Russia, sure.
Oh, yeah. You get a conquest, too, of someone who had a good holy site adjacency set up. It happens. But yeah, that's pretty situational.
As for the remaining scientists there, the ones that trigger the Eureka moment, Phil alluded to this individual earlier, the one that triggers a Eureka moment for all technologies from the information era.
Mm-hmm.
Abdus Salam. Yes, yes. Thank you. I will gladly take that individual.
Does anyone have to worry about choosing which ones?
Yeah, I just get all of them.
Our Habatier in the classical era?
Oh, 3 Eurekas.
All right. That's okay.
Yeah, 3 Eurekas instead of just 2, because it's still level 2. There's to be one in each era that gives you the 3 random technologies from that era or the next era.
It's a nice little boost.
It depends what you've researched already, too, because you can greatly increase your odds of getting Eurekas towards something useful if you've already gotten Eurekas that are available to you and you've cleared out the cheaper techs for one reason or another.
That's true. Not all Eurekas are equal.
Yeah. But you can put some weights in those dice that you're rolling when you're doing this. And it's worth considering because, again, the science you can get from that can easily overpower the science from the plus one to libraries. And that is available early.
Classical era, yes. It's less likely to be that those 3 random technologies you get the Eureka for you already have or are about to get anyway. And it's earlier on in the game, so even back to my own criteria earlier on in the game, yes.
It depends how well you're micromanaging your eurekas, but if you are and you're caring about science, you should have most of the attainable eurekas to you already.
And then, yes, there are those that have the specific eureka triggers. Dmitry Mendeleev was mentioned because he's an industrial era. He's the one for chemistry. Plus, you get one random from the industrial era. There's also computers, Eureka Moment, Alan Turing in the modern era, and then you get one random technology from the modern era as well for Eureka Moment. And then there's the mathematics one, the classical era one, Euclid, which also gives you one random Eureka from the medieval era.
It does give you Petra, so if you're looking to seal that desert point, you kind of want that as soon as possible.
Uh-huh. Man, that's niche, though. Is there a normal Eureka for mathematics? Like, what's the normal criteria there?
Three different specialty districts.
Oh, my gosh. Ooh, yeah, that's I have no idea then.
Seems like a balance between the ones that are conditional, the ones that are always there but not that impressive, versus the ones that you may never get to. It's really hard to get a good opinion on things like without really diving into all these.
These guys in general are weaker than generals and merchants as well.
Yes. Still very good.
Still worth pursuing because they're on different poles. You're not losing the opportunity to get the merchants by going for these. So if you have the campuses, and you probably have at least a few, they're worth pursuing.
And admittedly, I would say in most games, the great people that you're probably going to have the most difficulty getting, that you're going to consistently have the most competition for, not necessarily any individual one, but actually getting one, short of certain civs being on the map, would be a great scientist. Because it is rare, although I have seen it, taking over a civ, even in mid-game, you know, like medieval, and they don't seem to have any campuses anywhere. You're checking how many great scientist points per turn people are generating. It's usually very, very, very close. So it's a very crowded group of people trying to get into this pool of great scientists.
Why do trade routes not directly benefit the receiving civ?
Oh, I'm going to be sending a trade route to this particular civilization. Here is what I'm going to be getting in terms of food, gold, all that stuff. The city that is getting it, I mean, yes, they're getting a road. Okay, yes, they're going to be able to benefit from the road that's being constructed between the two cities. And you might be thinking, thank you for sending me that trade road. I can now march my army that much more quickly to you and squash you. But the trade route itself, in terms of what the trader is actually doing, unlike, say, in Civilization V, where the receiving civ also receives something, and no, I don't think it should be just as good or certainly not better than the person who sent the trade route, because you went to the effort to send it, and you've got to protect it. But there's no reciprocation. What's going on?
Maybe they don't want to disincentivize international trade routes even further by having it benefit your opponents.
Yeah, because generally, if I'm having to send trade routes, I'll pick city-states or the human players I'm cooperating with. Because I still have that mindset from Civ 5. I don't want you to get additional science or gold or culture or what have you from this trade route so you can get stronger faster. I'm going to send it to people who can use it or won't be trying to take me over.
Yeah, although it's nice to build roads to your enemy.
Yeah.
But that's because they're not getting benefits from you doing that.
Yeah, it's hard to get used to that, like, after playing Civ 5 for so long, for sure.
Yeah.
I would just make the argument that some kind of calculation based on the direct benefits, so those absolute output, every single turn you're getting X number of gold. Okay, so maybe as an example, if you are the sending civ, oh, I'm going to get 4 gold a turn from that. The receiving civ gets 1, and that could be a combination of distance and the size of the city and what's already in the city. Like, for example, it would make sense that if you're sending a trader to a city that has a commercial hub, that receiving civ should be getting more gold than a civ that does not have a commercial hub in that receiving city, because it's, oh, there's all this gold. What are we supposed to do with that? Oh, here, talk to the merchants. They know what to do with that, and off it goes.
You're basically saying that we should nerf international trade routes, and I disagree. We should not nerf international trade routes.
Well, international trade routes are, like, less stable, right? So you want them to be worth more, in my opinion.
Yeah, they are less stable, and right now, because of the benefits you get from the food and hammers, especially the hammers, unless you're getting something really juicy, but if your opponent is then also being conferred that benefit, and in a normal Civ game, they're all opponents, it's not like our turn cast co-op stuff, it makes it even harder to justify using the international trade route for anything other than just building a road to somebody that you intend to slaughter. I feel like that should not be your sole consideration of when you ever do it, is that or like a city-state class. To me, I want to be making an evaluation of the trade-off.
Well, of course.
And saying, okay, sometimes this is actually better. But giving my opponent benefits does not make me evaluate the option more strongly.
Perhaps they'll actually do a little bit more with diplomacy and trade, you know, and allow options there, and then maybe they'll rework it. I mean, I know this is a lot of conjecture, but maybe that's something that they'll look into later, because certainly an area for improvement.
Once you make it good enough and that you create some incentive for your opponent to destroy it, but then you can also have a situation where maybe your opponent also wants to trade with you, and so you have an agreement where you don't kill each other's trade route, so you both get ahead or something. That could work if the diplomacy in the game was functional.
Yeah.
Well, but without having to have each trade route you individually send also benefit your opponent.
Well, how about this then? If through diplomatic interaction, if you are friends with another civilization, whether it's a human player or an AI, or other humans with each other, other AI with each other, then the receiving civ would receive some benefit from that trade route. Not the same amount. Definitely not like one gold per one gold or anything like that. But then you're connecting with the, okay, I don't mind the receiving civ benefiting from this, at least at this particular point in time, because after all, trade routes are going to come up for renewal. But I'm friends with you right now, and so because we're friends right now, you're less likely, as soon as the friendship is over, to go ahead and declare war and then squash my trade route. So because of that, and we have an existing relationship, I don't mind giving you kind of a very small benefit in exchange for my sending you a trade route. So then you would have that connection to the diplomacy, which would make diplomacy a little more interesting, and diplomacy can use all the help it could get.
I don't like this one.
While at the same time not adversely affecting the value of international trade routes, full stop.
If you require the friendship for this, then you're going to get arguments between people. I'm sending more trade routes than you are. Send more trade routes because you're getting more benefit than me, and that kind of nonsense. And if we're talking AI, then I mean, just get the milk out of the fridge because that's what this is going to be. You're just going to milk the AI.
I think it'd be really nice if you're able to just say like, I don't want your trade routes, right? Like, have the benefit there, but be able to say, like, I don't want your trade routes. That way, if you have somebody who's just benefiting from it, you don't want to declare war on them, but you do want to, like, say, like, hey, I don't want you to keep benefiting from these.
So you're thinking something along the lines of, say, you know, I don't want to declare war on this civilization because they got all these religious units in here. Well, that's, of course, very effective. Can you just walk over them? But fine, then I'm going to combat your religious units with my religious units, and we can have a religious conflict even though the civilizations themselves are not at war. So you could have something similar in diplomacy that perhaps if you say, hey, if you don't stop sending trade routes to me, then I'm going to activate something. You could embed it within an existing unit, for example.
I was just thinking their units can't come in anymore. Like kind of like a closed borders, but for traders.
Yeah.
People can't just take advantage of, like, just, like, saying, hey, I'm sending you trade routes. You better declare war on me if you want to stop. Okay, I don't want to do that. That's a little extreme, like.
Yeah, I can see that.
But it is some value, right, to receiving a trade route and getting at least a little bit out of it. Maybe you can think about, like, where you're going to position yourself on the map, right? Like, if you're in between a bunch of people, that's not a great situation, but at least maybe you have the benefit of getting some trade routes through.
Well, you're not
territory.
Making that choice, though. You're kind of given that hand regardless.
That's true, but I mean, like, if you expand to locations that are between people, then you're making that decision, right?
I guess. I'm just picturing what that looks like when you actually go for it in practice in a game.
I guess in practice maybe you would want to do that. Like, yeah. I think about it, but I guess it depends if it's single player or multiplayer, and there comes the issue again, right?
Yeah, but I'd like the mechanic designed in a way that you could use it functionally in multiplayer.
Yeah, no, I understand. I think either way, at least, like, as long as you have some sort of control over what happens with trade and maybe they implement it through diplomacy, it'll be more interesting.
Yeah, I think that would help. If you have, like, a diplo control on it and it's significantly stronger, noticeably stronger than internal trade routes, so you have some incentive to use it, that could help because that would actually get some people to the table in diplomacy, too.
Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah.
If we had a situation where it was embedded within the diplomacy that, okay, in order for there to be trade routes to be established between two civilizations, we're going to have an agreement that that's going to be acceptable, like having an open border to move your military units or your civilian units across, then in that case, now there is a direct benefit for the receiving civ because you had to have decent enough relations with that other person or that AI or between AIs in order to be able to have that. And so now if you want to take advantage of it, now it's on you to ensure that you have a sufficient number of trade routes and to actually construct that trader and to send it to that civ and then continue to protect from other civs or barbarians or a combination of the two. I would be okay with looking at it that way.
Yeah, me too. I like that a lot more.
I was just looking, how can we have it so that the receiving civ benefits directly from the trade route other than just the fact the road has been constructed.
You said something about being able to start a relationship and then have people trade with you, right? I was just saying it'd be less clicks if you can trade by default, and then you can just say no if you see that trade route coming and you're the other civ. I just think that's, like, simpler. That's all.
Yeah, that's fine.
It's a little less involved, but I want to just have less clicks than there already are.
And there are other 4X games that do sort of have mechanics similar to that, like Sins of a Solar Empire. You can have just trading alliances, and that doesn't even affect whether you're shooting at them or not. So there are ways of implementing that.
Mid to end game bland by getting fat on CSC here.
Wow.
That's the thing. That is literally the handle, and apparently a lot of the handle. Like, what do you want me to say?
Wow.
This isn't one of those ones where I'm mispronouncing it. I think it's pretty obvious. Anyway, the gist of this thread is maybe to bring stuff, corporations, ideology, pressure, culture flip, all that kind of thing back into the game. He feels that there's not a lot going on in the end game. But I'm not sure that this is a fixable problem in practice in Civ, unless you drastically alter the design and model of the Civ game in general, or the Civ series in general. Because, like, the first response post here by Art and Morty, the point comes too soon where it feels like only large-scale war is going to change anything about how the mid-end game is going to play out. That has been true in every Civilization game that I've ever touched. Someone starts to get in front, and unless you put them down, they're going to win in every game.
It's been that way since Civ 1.
Yep. My problem with this is that the time between when this starts and when this ends is too long. In IRL terms, in per-turn terms, however you want to measure it, someone's running away, and that someone's going to win, and there's way too much time between when that's true and when that someone wins.
Yeah, also in the thread came up with comparisons to previous Civilization titles, and then yes, generally the consensus that this is a Civilization issue full stop, and some people started to make the argument that, well, it is worse in Civ 6 than it was in, say, Quantity X, and one of those individuals is K.A.U., who said, I think it was a bit better in Civ 5 for a couple of reasons, and by a bit better, I think he means it was not as bland, not that it was more bland based on the subject title. He said, I could play tall, which meant I didn't have to spend 90% of my time making mundane decisions about production cues. And there were some new elements introduced in the late game, most relatedly to the World Congress, ideology, and cooperative projects. Okay, cooperative projects, those were a kind of a neat little thing that you could do. Oh, let's have the international games, for example. But that wasn't make or break. That gave you such a competitive advantage that you won because of that. It certainly wouldn't hurt you, but I don't feel that's going to help with mid to late game drag, although I wouldn't mind seeing that back again. World Congress itself, idea is fine, but implementation, dear me.
But ideologies too, like,
yes,
there's not a lot of depth there. It was contrived diplomatic conflict. In other words, real players wouldn't give a crap what ideology you picked, unless you picked something too strong or weak or whatever. And the AIs cared about that instead of actually victory conditions.
We have been friends for 100 turns or whatever it happens to be. Oh, you're a different ideology than I am. I hate you.
Yeah.
You hate my choice, but suddenly we're not friends anymore? What do you mean you're declaring war on me? Wait, what? I'm like a couple of eras ahead of you. That was probably to your benefit. Okay, I'm just going to turn around and squash you. Yeah, they prioritize ideology too much to their own detriment, so that was a major problem, as you say, Phil. It was egregious in that respect, and in a multiplayer situation, eh?
Yeah, no one cared. Aside from the fact that if someone got to ideologies much before you and were getting those bonuses, that's a major red flag. But the ideology choice itself, not really. And no, the answer to mundane clicks is not to force quote-unquote tall flight. The answer to mundane clicks is to bring the UI up from 20 years ago and make it a functional UI, and then they won't have nearly as many mundane clicks.
I agree. I think that one of the things that comes up again with this situation, whether you're playing single or multiplayer, and it would be nice if this was designed to work in both, right? So maybe if you pick an ideology, there's just some stuff you can't do with other civilizations anymore, like diplomacy-wise, you know, that you're just very restricted. maybe that could be of interest. Now, obviously, the diplomacy system is not really there yet, but maybe if there was a lot of stuff that was suddenly limited when you pick a different ideology, that could be of some interest. Maybe the warmonger penalties for declaring war on a different ideology are higher on the same, you know.
You'd have to rework warmonger penalties, but it's a good idea in concept because you want stuff that players who are actual players, you know, human beings interacting with each other would actually use. You are picking ideologies that constrain you in some ways, which give you big bonuses in other ways. That could be a good mechanic depending on how it's implemented.
Yeah.
And it would certainly be better than what we had in so five ideologies, which were just you get some bonuses and people randomly don't like you, but only if they're AI. Yeah,
and it feels so arbitrary, you know? Like, I don't like that feeling of arbitrary conflict, right? Just like in Beyond Earth, it's like, oh, I hate you more and more and more. Like, okay, cool. Like, what do you want from me? It doesn't feel real.
Well, you have victory conditions in the game, which is a separation from reality already. However, if you're going to include them in the game, then the player should be making decisions based on their existence. Because otherwise, they're not playing the same game. They're just
exactly. Yeah.
Shane rightly points out in the chat that, yes, it's the nature of a 4X game, like Civ. Since your first turn is always going to be of more value than your second turn because Civ has that snowball effect. So an action in turns 1 to 10 is much more powerful than 100 to 110. Yes, because of the time that you're going to then to be able to build on that, the kind of risk-reward. But at the same time, you don't want it to be such that there is no value or the value is random number generator. You either are all in and you blow it out of proportion how worthwhile it is. It's like, okay, everything I did up to the mid to late game doesn't seem to matter anymore because now I'm the only person on this planet with this ideology in Civilization V. Or that's nice, but I'm just going to continue doing what it is that I already did, and it has absolutely no impact whatsoever, again, on what it is that I'm currently progressing towards. We need somewhere in the middle. The extremes are easy. Civ has done that many times. We need to find that middle ground, and for right now, of course, within the Civilization VI context.
I think that when you think about this whole like issue about like, oh, it's getting boring, you know, it's getting bland, that's the symptom, right? The main issue, right, is that you can't really get to the end of the game. I mean, you just don't think you're going to win, right, once you're behind. But I think that the more important thing is to have fun, right? Like, if you were having a good time, even if you were losing, that'd be fine. But you're, like, bored and you're losing. If you can manage to make it interesting, regardless of whether you're winning or not, I think that that might solve this problem to a decent degree. Like, you're probably not going to win, but if the game's still entertaining, you're not going to care that much, are you? You know?
I think the game needs to be entertaining either way. Good example is there are plenty of times in Civ 4 or Civ 5, or even Civ 6, although I just went military now, but, like, I would be going for culture in Civ 4, and I would have set up the AI to the point where I knew I could not be declared on. In other words, I was guaranteed to win. But that was so dull. You just hit end turn, and wait. You have a counter on the screen. Like, hey, I know for a fact, like, I can calculate it down to the turn. I'm going to win 45 turns from now.
Yeah, that's
yay. Bad. And yeah, okay, I'm not going to lose. I know I'm not going to lose, but that's, ugh.
The novelty factor wears off pretty quickly on that number two. Civilization is supposed to be about replayability, so if you know that I'm going to set this up and I'm always going to win, and as you said, you calculated it down to the exact turn, that sounds nice if you're trying to, I don't know, reproduce something historically accurate, for example, but when you're trying to get immersed in something and feel like that you are challenged, that perhaps the AI recognizes, hey, I see what you're doing, or at the very least, they then decide, like, oh, you're playing against this civilization this time, or this civilization is your neighbor, and they take this action that's different, then there's actually a chance that you might not be able to replicate what you have done or could have done dozens and dozens of times over, which leads you to quitting the game before you ever get anywhere near a victory condition, which also comes up in the thread as Civilization VI, I quit games more quickly than I did in previous Civilization games. I don't care about the victory conditions, and that's because of this lull in the mid to late game. Start a new game.
And I think part of that is, I think we've already touched on it, that the culture victory is a bit nebulous. We'll use that word. There isn't really a diplomacy victory. You've got religious, but that's probably going to happen early, if anything. So at the end, it's really science or military, and so you're probably just going to beeline into one of those, and that's not going to be interesting if you're doing that every game.
But science is military, because, like, you can end the game with nukes if you get them before other people. There's no need for a ship.
That's its own problem.
You are very quickly, again, at a point where you know you're going to win. There's no opposition there. It is just going through the motions at that point. The decisions aren't meaningful anymore because basically as long as you don't throw, you won.
One thing, too, that's hard is implementing other people having a chance without making it a catch-up mechanic, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Maybe in the late game, if you can screw up harder, it's not going to feel like, oh, somebody caught up to you, the bigger mistakes that you can make. I was also thinking, like, maybe every era can have its own thing that makes it different. I think that that would help, too, keep it interesting.
Well, you just say you don't want catch-up mechanics, but if they're implemented correctly, you know, that could actually be one way of doing that. In Civ 5, there were a couple of World Congress things that gave a leg up to those who were a little behind. But, you know, if you formulated it properly, you know, that rubber banding mechanic, it works in other games. It could work here, too.
It's worked in Civ 4. Civ 5 also had spies, and Civ 4 had spies. And in both of those cases, espionage was a way you could cover ground in science at an abnormal rate relative to your empire's capabilities. Especially if you did it correctly. Like, it's not bad as long as it's not ridiculous.
Yeah, you can also slow down how hard people can snowball, I guess, but that might make the game boring.
I mean, maybe not. It doesn't matter how hard they snowball if the game ends pretty quickly after they do.
That's true.
Like something like the old Warlords games did. If you were winning by enough, the AI would just be like, okay, nobody's going to stop you now, so if you want, you can just win. Like, you have like over half of the cities. I forget the exact trigger for it, but basically, like, if you'll stop slaughtering us, you can win the game. And that's the closest thing you're going to get to a real Diplo win in this game, because that's how you win, quote unquote, diplomatically in multiplayer. Everyone realizes that they can't stop you anymore, even if they all dogpile you. So they just call the game a win for you. That's a Diplo win in my mind, an actual Diplo win.
Yeah.
It's already happening in Spirit. People are quitting games because they know that the game's over for one way or another. Either they are going to win or they are certainly not going to win, but it's going to be another 4 hours before that happens. Like, come on.
I think it's a mix of both, though. I think it's because, you know, they're not going to win and because they're bored. Like, if you're having fun, like, I don't think you'd care that much.
Well, that's true, but
truly
a big part of the fun in this game is making meaningful choices as you're going through the game. And the combination of UI slugfest and knowing that no matter what choices you make at this point, you're not going to win or you are going to win, really put a hamper on your chances of having fun.
This is in the multiplayer game all the time, because we get to a point where we're not technically we haven't won, but between the three of us as human players, even if there's just like three of us and one runaway eye, we know that we can dogpile it eventually, but we don't want to spend another 3 hours doing that when we could start a new game.
Mm. Yep.
When it comes to victory conditions, there should be a way, depending upon how you're playing it, to accelerate getting to that victory condition. Because there's always the option, of course, like, well, after I get the victory condition, gee, that victory condition came too soon, I want to keep playing. Well, you can, of course, still do that. Although I remember in the original Civilization, you could not. Thank you for having save games, and I could go back and just leave this one AI by itself with one city. But when it's a 4X game, this awful, and I say awful balance, it's awful because it's difficult to find, but it's also very intriguing because it sparks a lot of good conversation. When you're exploring, expanding, exploiting, and exterminating, at some point, yes, there's someone that's going to be running away. So the victory condition should be able to recognize that. Drew Singh talked about how, say, in Civilization 4, right, the domination victory, you had a combination of territory, as I pointed out, also world population. That was a considerable help because more often than not, we would have games that achieved a formal victory before we said, can we just call this and say so-and-so, air quotes, won? Not to say that you can't have your own individual victory conditions, but the game should be recognizing and taking into account, however that works out, this person is a runaway. This person is going to win, while at the same time not having the runaway happen so fast that it doesn't give somebody who maybe made a mistake on turn 20 to try to correct that or to have a little bit of a course correction on turn 60 so they have a chance to be competitive once again without saying, oh, well, so now you're going to penalize the person or players that were doing what they were supposed to be doing in the first 50 turns of the games, and now you know you're kind of bringing them down because you're trying to bring the other person up artificially. There's got to be that balance in there so that ultimately we get to, there's a victory condition within a reasonable amount of time that you are not bored, at least for an extended period of time, that it's not bland, that you had interesting choices, and I want to play this again because I can make a series of different choices and I could change the outcome of the game. I think it's a lot easier to say than to actually do, but I think there's been enough in Civ history that perhaps sometimes when it comes to that third old, third new, third modified rule that they've been working on at Firaxis and Civilization titles and Civilization 3, that perhaps they take away or they modify things that didn't need to be taken away or modified, where they're trying to add and change other things. Because I think if you take little bits from what Civ 4 had and Civ 5 and Civ 6 had, you could have this victory condition that was meaningful and satisfying.
Yeah, I agree. And maybe they could propose some victory conditions that are like early, potentially, victory conditions, right? Ones that, like you said, like adjust to what's going on and kind of call it early. That would be nice, like as an option.
Yeah.
Put that in the game.
You don't have to accept the victory condition as the winner.
Yeah. Or you could just like take it, right, before you make the game. It's like, I want these conditions.
Oh, yeah.
Variable, whatever you want to call them. That way you at least have the option of saying, like, I don't want to play till the end of the game. Like, I don't care if then it's not epic or whatever. I just want to close it out when I know I'm going to win.
Yeah.
I don't have a problem if the game is going 250, 300 turns. If everyone is so close neck and neck, half a dozen turns or a single turn can make a difference. That's interesting. That's exciting. That's like it's the bottom of the ninth and it's 4-4 right now. That's interesting. But get to the bottom of the ninth and, okay, so it's, you know, 21-2. Well, yeah, it's possible you're going to be able to roll that over into the 10th inning, but how likely is that? And that's a lot of effort. How much fun is that?
Exactly. There's a lot they could do, as I think we can all agree on, multiple fronts, whether it's better victories or more interesting gameplay later on. There's a lot that can be done.
If I feel like I have to restart a game before a victory condition is achieved, I want to be blaming myself more than the game itself, because then it's, okay, either I need to change what it is that I'm doing, I'm just going to keep doing what it is that I'm doing and get used to it, as opposed to, man, there was nothing else I could have done because the mechanics screwed me over.
Yeah, yeah.
Either that or the mechanics screwed me over because I don't understand it as well as I should. Oh, okay, then that's on me at this point because I decided to move up in difficulty or I've never played against this civilization before. You know, to recognize the complexity so it's not too simple, but it's also that it's not too complicated to get a victory condition in a decent amount of time and feel like that was worth it. Because after all, playing a Civ game isn't an investment in time. It's not like sitting down and playing Minesweeper. No offense, Minesweeper. Recorded for episode 288 with Makalua, Mad Jin, Drew Sane, Jonah Falcon, and the Chris D.
Fantasy Flight Games has announced that in quarter four, that was very specific of them, but a new Civilization-based board game, Sid Meier's Civilization A New Dawn. Apparently also make an XCOM board game, which is kind of bizarre to me.
It's almost a real-time game in which you have a certain amount of moments to do it before the game moves on without you.
Oh.
I think a lot of these kind of board games and a lot of tie-ins, like as you can see, the Civ board game. They're also makers of Twilight Imperium. Twilight Imperium 4 was just announced and is released this weekend at Gen Con, I think.
And by the way, for those of you who don't know, there were two Civilization games that were released before this one. I remember because I have the original Civilization board game, which came with a metric crap ton of units. Then they slimmed it down. And a lot of people who like these Civilization-type board games usually rave about Through the Ages. I don't know if you've played that. It's one of those games which is an hour per player playing, so it can get to Twilight Imperium length if you let it.
Oh, man.
Is that the 1990 version or the 2000 version, or 2003 version?
I think it was 2000 version of Civilization, the board game, which was basically very straight up, a lot of units and a lot of pieces, while the second game, and I forgot it, stripped it down so that it was mostly about developing your nations and technologies. And judging by what Fantasy Flight is doing, they're modifying that second game.
So they're basically turning the Civ 4 version into this now Civ 6-esque version.
Yeah, someone in the thread has said it uses more of the Civ 6 graphics, though. So
yeah, all of the Civ 6 graphics have noticed. You have Teddy, you have Kathy, you have Tamiris, of all things.
I'm looking forward to it because I'm very much into them. Sometimes a little bit more than computer games because you actually get to interact with other people and touch the pieces while it's kind of hard to pick up pieces in Civilization VI.
Yeah.
Unless you really want to ruin your monitor.
In the future when you have tables with holograms that are movable.
Ed Beach talked about it. The game shares a pregame map generation mechanic with one of his all-time favorite games,
battle sheet. And it's true, because all the tiles are like chunky tiles that you randomly put together, so the map can be slightly different.
Looks like they're hexagonal pieces that you can rearrange any way you like.
Yeah, and battle sheet's a fun game.
Here's the thing about it, though. One of the major stumbling blocks to the previous two Civ games is that they could take a long time, and they don't really say what their play time is. If they can get a game that can be played in 90 minutes, then I think a lot of people would be attracted to it, because that's one of the problems with these Civ-type board games is that they go on and on and on and on and on, and sometimes people don't have the time for that.
Kids these days.
But the previous one's four-player games, because I noticed this one is like almost specifically designed for four people. Or at least based on the pre-release photos of mock games in action. So maybe they're toning it down a bit. And maybe the technology is being kind of streamlined, because we noticed that everyone starts with specific orders of basically certain technologies and civics from the game itself. And so maybe it's the order of those and how you replace and upgrade them over time that makes it quicker. Who knows?
It'd be really nice if it's instead of an I go, you go, it's a we go. Everybody does their simultaneous turns in secret. I don't think that's what's going to happen, but that would be a nice little twist to the game.
Well, I think how many people can you really get around a giant map? Chances of getting eight people constantly showing up to be able to do a single game, and then being able to complete that game.
It's hard to do that online as it is.
Yeah. This is better for being able to do short, quick games, especially with limited like this. Multiple other games are very similar that way. That way it keeps the time short, and you can even probably do it competitively.
We should also mention it's pre-ordering for $50 US. Here's the thing about that, though. The code for the games is Civ 01, which seems to indicate to me that, yeah, they're planning multiple expansions to this.
Yep. Maybe they're going to follow the expansions of Civ 6 every time.
Well, yeah, just include new Civs. That's the most obvious part of it.
Yeah.
They're going to just basically be releasing booster packs of these Civ cards for a fiver in your local game shop.
Yeah, possible.
The Civs it comes with are the Aztecs, France, Egypt, Rome, America, Scythia, Japan, and Sumeria.
You can't really see most of their abilities unless someone else has scans for everywhere else. They're somewhat similar to the main game.
Max patch came out last week, and after another week, we've got the Linux patch out. So they're not talking to each other yet, but everyone is now up to date, so to speak.
Aspire Media, who is behind the ports of both the Mac and the Linux version of Civilization VI, said, yeah, here's your summer 2017 update, but we've come across quote-unquote nasty cross-platform bugs.
What a surprise.
We didn't want to delay the release of the content anymore, so here's the patch, and we're going to continue to work on cross-platform. And I think part of the reason we keep talking about still not cross-platform yet is because we were told from the beginning that that was going to be a thing. And, we're almost at a year since Civilization VI was released. Wow, aren't we old? But, this summer 2017 update, that came out a month and a half ago on PC. Cross-platform was already an issue, and it seemed like my take was that they were delaying the patch to try to get the cross-platform thing working. But if they're talking about nasty bugs, I'm surprised it took them 6 weeks to realize it's so nasty, we better just go ahead and release it. But I guess better late than never.
From what I can tell, the big issue is Firaxis and Asper both have to do things to fix this bug, and trying to get that organized is taking longer than I think they planned.
Some people at Aspire, and actually with that point, there was a comment on the Steam forums by someone from Aspire where they actually laid the full blame on 2K and Firaxis. And I thought, even if that's true, we as the general public don't need to know that that's either your opinion or a fact.
Okay, maybe the public doesn't need to know that, but if the tendency is to blame Aspire for the inability to do cross-platform when it's out of their hands, I feel like to some degree they are justified in pointing out, hey, we cannot do this without help from the company that's advertising that this will be available. we're not being given the chance for this one.
Oh, I agree they shouldn't shoulder it entirely. It's just the way it was phrased. Say, yes, we need to work with 2K and Firaxis, not it's 2K and Firaxis' fault. Blaming the blame game on either Aspire or 2K and Firaxis does nobody any good.
I guess not. I'm not convinced, though.
Really? I couldn't tell.
this is something they've advertised from the start. If they are not putting a serious emphasis on actually delivering that, I think that's good information to know as a consumer.
once you've done that publicly, it makes a lot of things more difficult. So,
yeah, unfortunately for you as well. So, like, it might not have been the best strategic move for Aspire to do it. But as a consumer, I don't mind seeing that because I want to know if it's true, first off, because that would change my opinion pretty drastically as well. But, yeah.
There's the truth and there's the whole truth, and then there's what you say as well as how you say it.
Yeah.
Maybe part of the issue then is we don't have the cross-platform yet because Aspire, along with 2K and Firaxis, are not getting along with each other. Because if that's what they're saying publicly, then...
Well, that's pretty clear at this point.
Yeah. Like, what's going on behind the scenes, guys? Does someone else be doing this?
Support the ongoing Polycast Patreon campaign.
Collective achievements.
Personal incentives.
Month-to-month commitment.
For more information, visit thepolycast.net/Patreon.
Call it today.
In North America, 301-637-7659.
In Europe, 44-121-288-7659.
The only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about.
Log on to the series official website at
thepolycast.net.
Shall I close this up then?
Let's do it.
All right. This has been Polycast episode 290 with your host,
Dan Q.
Spooning.
Makalua.
Can I stab you with a fork now?
I don't know. Can you?
Me and team.
As long as that fork comes into the back for Dan.
This week's wonderful guest, Brian McNamara.
Thank you, and I am going to sleep the moment this ends.
And myself, ZT's Irish.
So wait, ZT, are you saying you are not a wonderful guest?
Just a basic guy, man.
But can a basic guy also not be a wonderful guest at the same time? Why does it have to be mutually exclusive?
You could try.
Well, it's like RimWorld. He's just very impressive, because that's more efficient.
There you go. Just focusing on one stat. So I guess I could say the guest co-host for the week, right?
Well, yeah, you could do that. Unless you were thinking, you know, that Byte was the wonderful guest and you were the wonderful new regular co-host, but I thought we already went over that, that that wasn't actually the case. So,
and guest co-host, Makalua.
I know.
Well, then Mackie's a permanent guest then.
I'm still amazed that you they called you a guest.
I know.
That's good stuff.
Mackie's a guest. What the heck am I?
It might have been, like, really
a drop-in host?
Apparently. That might have some implications. I don't know. But that's okay. I'll be the drop-in host.
Drop-in host.
Phil and Naki, thanks for returning to the show. Wait, bye.
Yeah, thanks for being hard to read.
Hey.
I'm just the drop-in host, man.
I'm thanking the drop-in host, Phil, for returning and the guest for Mackie for returning. I think we're just completely set, right? I mean...
Yeah.
So much side eye face right now.
Now, is it bad enough that you wish we would make the reference to you being the only woman on the internet? Is it that bad?
No.
Oh, it's not that bad. Okay, well. All right.
We don't need to bring that joke back for 2017.
Oh, okay. Well, so we still have some work to do, all right, to get it to be that bad. All right.
But Mackie.
Like, no.
Nice. There's how you pronounce Luffy's username.
Thank you. Thank you for that.
You're welcome.
Makalua.
Mikey's going to be so disappointed you didn't mispronounce it. Oh. Ah, well, should get over
I'm Australian. Polynesian names are not.
Not going to be a problem.
No. Okay, so thank you, Makalua. After all that, I stuffed it up again.
Apparently really quiet. Oh, hang on.
I was about to jump in on you, tell you that.
Oh, okay. That should be better now. Should be. I forgot that, yes, once the live stream starts, I have to adjust the audio levels again. Oh, hang on. Oh. There we go. All right, we should be much, much, much better now. Hopefully, nope. What?
Nope.
Huh. Oh, there we go. I forgot about the delay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Slight delay.
Has to go through the tubes. That were installed by Al Gore.
Oh, man.
Oh. That's a deep cut right there.
There is no segue, so segue. They're saying in the chat, yes, time for a UI cast. Oh, if we're going to have a UI cast, I'm not starting with Civilization VI. Dear Microsoft.
Shots fired.
Record date?
September 16th, 2017.
Civilization 4, 5, and Beyond Earth Sound Clips, copyright Take 2 Interactive. Copyright Civilized Communication at civcom.net.